Alright, well that leads us to our big gun. So, from right here in town also, our very own Travis.
How's it going everybody? I'm Travis, I'm an alcoholic. Well, I got a lot more time to burn than Robert, so we're going to go way back. Understand who Travis the alcoholic is. You got to know where Travis the alcoholic came from. I was raised around a large group of alcoholics that I share a last name with. I think the first time I got drunk, I was probably 3-4 years old at a family function. Probably younger than that. My dad used to give me whiskey to shut me up and put me to sleep. It was just normalized my whole life. The one thing that wasn't normal was me. I always had a real hard time making friends, finding a group, finding my groove, finding an identity. It's like, I don't know if you remember elementary school, but there was always that one weird kid that ate bugs and like tasted the paste and stuff. That kid didn't want to hang out with me. He thought I was weird. And I was real hyper. I was real active. I got kicked out of class a lot, so I didn't learn a lot. I just knew I was different all the way up until I was probably about 11 or 12 years old, and my best friend's older brother, he gave me beer, and it was the first time I'd gotten drunk on my own accord. And then all of a sudden, I was the coolest, I was the funniest, I was the smoothest, I was the slickest, I was the hippest, I was the raddest person in the room, and I was 11 years old. And I just took that ball and I ran with it. And at that point, I realized that I could fit in, and I could get attention, and I could manipulate people to get what I wanted, and I could get everything that I thought was missing on the inside by being who you wanted me to be on the outside. And alcohol was what got me there. I don't care if you wanted to watch me ride a shopping cart off that roof, I'll do it. You know, I was that guy. And it just snowballed. It started out slow, it progressed fast, and it escalated and peaked. Right when it probably should have started, when I was 21, I started getting arrested. And first time I got arrested, I think there was some weed, some meth, and a stolen beer involved. And I went to jail, and that's where I learned about AA, because you do anything you can to get out of the pod for an hour or so. And I got out, and they sentenced me to a card. So I went there, and I was like, this is going to work. I'm going to get off dope, and this is going to be great. I'm still going to smoke weed. I'm still going to drink beer, and I'm going to get off dope, and this is going to be great. I didn't really pay much attention. I didn't really do what I needed. I just did what everybody expected me to say. I said it, I did it, whatever it was. And then when I got out of there and I got my card filled, I went on my way back to whatever I was doing before. And then 12 or 13 arrests later, there was some coke involved and I got sentenced again. And I was like, I'm gonna use this, I'm gonna go through the motions, I'm gonna get off coke, I'm gonna quit doing coke. So again, same story, went through it. Didn't really listen, didn't really pay attention. Didn't really do much of anything except what I thought people wanted me to do. And then got that card filled, went to court, went back to what I was doing. Probably another 10 or 11 arrests later, I don't know how many arrests we're up to by now, but there's quite a few in this story. I started listening to some older guys in the meetings, and then I started thinking about it. I went to the meeting, and instead of doing what that sign says, I measured myself against whoever was the lowest in the room. Whoever had found the lowest bottom they could find, I decided I could go back out, and there was more to dig, because I'm not as bad as that guy, or I'm not as bad as that girl. It obviously gets worse. You know, so I came in here looking for excuses to go back out. Not coming in here looking for reasons to fix myself. I came in here looking for reasons why I wasn't that bad yet. So I went back out and did my thing. And so on and so forth. It was in and out. It was in and out. It was in and out. It was back and forth. And I don't really want to spend this whole time talking about what it was, even though I have way more time in what it was than I do in what it is. But finally, it all came to a pinnacle. One faithful night, January 13th, 2020, at the ripe age of 38 years old, I drank almost 60 beers that day. And I came home and got in an argument with my wife. And my at the time, he was 14 years old. My son stood up to me. And when I got in his face, he dropped me. He dropped me with a right hook that I didn't see coming. I didn't know which one to look at. There was so many. But I probably should have picked the one in the middle. But yeah, he dropped me. He dropped me cold. And then we decided to fight it out. And the cops showed up. And I went to jail with a black eye and a busted lip and a destroyed ego and no pride left. I look like hot dog shit. But I was in the Santa Barbara County Jail again, and I was sitting at the table in the front. There's all these assholes around me talking about what they're going to do when they got out and how badass they were when they weren't in there and how amazing things were. And I was just sitting there up against the bars, just ugly crying, like someone ran over my puppy dog. There's snot bubbles, tears, bawling. And then this guy walks up and says, "Hey, you don't look so good." I'm like, "Yeah, you're just an asshole, the obvious." And he prayed with me, and then we talked for a while. And I was scribbling out inspirational motives, trying to get myself to stop crying, and making a plan of what I was going to do to build my life back up. He's like, "You can probably forget all that stuff," and just he got me a number, and he said, "Call this guy when you get out." And I called him, and that guy told me, "Yeah, if you're serious, meet me at Starbucks at 9 a.m. If you're going to be late, just lose my number." And I was like, "All right." So I met him at Starbucks. I got there. And then, I met him. We talked for about a half hour over a cup of coffee. I didn't even like coffee at the time. I've been in here. I started drinking it, but that's what we do. Then he said, "Go to this meeting at this place downtown. It starts at noon. If you don't make it, I'll know. Lose my number." I was like, "All right, cool. I'm serious. I'll do it." So I made it there, and then so on and so forth. It went on like that for a little while. Then that was 2 years ago. And then about 6 months in, I got dispatched to hurricane cleanup in Houston. And I was scared to death. I did not know what I was going to do. I didn't know if I was going to make it. I didn't know how I was going to make it. I didn't know when I was going to make it. I just knew that I didn't want to go back to hospital visits and handcuffs, or on the really bad night, both. I went on that trip and I came back, and upon coming back, I got hit with divorce papers from my wife. I got hit with papers from the county that said a no contact order with my family, and I got hit with every reason to drink I could think of, but, you know, every reason I could come up with on my own, it was right there. But I didn't want to start over again. I didn't want to go back to that. I didn't want to be outcast from another group. I didn't want to ostracize myself more. I didn't want to dig. I needed to put the shovel down, and I knew I didn't want to dig deeper. I didn't want to dig in again. So I wasn't allowed to have contact with my family. I wasn't allowed to see my wife. She didn't want to be with me anymore. She found a new guy. I started coming on the up. I went and decided it was probably time to go to the doctor, not just the emergency room. And he hit me with a diagnosis of hepatitis C and said, "It's a good thing you quit drinking, because you had about 6 months left before it would be a slippery slope down." And and then COVID hit, and there's no more meetings, and now I'm sitting here staring at a phone screen, you know, white knuckle, grin and bear it. I think I cracked three teeth clenching them so hard. But it got real rough in that first 8 months or so, and I didn't know how I was going to make it. And when I made it through that, I kept coming to meetings. I kept going to meetings, and things started getting clearer. Nightmares started to subside. The cravings started to go away. The shakes didn't come back. You know, I could walk down the alley and smell someone smoking weed and not start drooling. It just, some semblance of normalcy started to come, and I didn't even know how to recognize it because it had been so abnormal for so long that I didn't know what was going on or where I was going to go, but I knew I was doing the right thing because I finally felt good. And then, I got dispatched again to when Texas had their freeze and all the pipes broke. I got sent to San Antonio. I was there for 6 months. I didn't go to many meetings when I went out of town because I didn't like being around strangers. I didn't feel comfortable in my skin yet. And I went on a fishing boat. I went on a charter in Port Aransas, Texas, out in the Gulf of Mexico. And I made friends with a guy in line. He came up without asking me, and he had pockets full of beers from the galley. He was like, I got us some beers. I said, no, that's cool. I don't drink. Thanks. And the deckhand was on the boat. And he's like, oh, man, are you in the program? And I was like, yeah, at home I am. He's like, I've been sober for 13 years. Come with me. And me and him made, you know, we started talking, we made friends. And then I went to a meeting in Texas, and all of a sudden I was like a novelty. I was a California guy that had the weird California accent. They wanted to know they didn't even think there were sober people in California. This one guy, he looked at me and he was like, are you like that California sober where you don't drink and smoke weed? No, I'm sober like you. He's like, I didn't think y'all did that over there. I was like, yeah, apparently we do. And yeah, I still talk to that guy probably once a month on Facebook. Every now and then I get a phone call. His name's Arthur. He's a pretty cool dude. So came back. Everybody, lo and behold, still sober. Travis is back. Started making my way up. I got my own house. I have my own residence now. It's the first time I've lived on my own, you know, other than out of someone else's couch or something like that. It's the first time I've lived on my own in my life. I went from my mom to my grandma to my wife. And then none of them wanted anything to do with me. I finally had to figure it out. And I made it all the way to my own apartment. And still making it to meetings, still going. And then just this last year, I got dispatched to New Orleans, Louisiana. And if there's any place where people go to get wasted and forget who they are or be whoever they want to be or just tell a handful of lies and get away with it, it's New Orleans, Louisiana. I found myself on Bourbon Street on my 40th birthday. Just looking at drunk people like when you go to the zoo and watch monkeys throw poop, watching, you know, I don't know, like, it was an experience, and I stayed sober through it. I thought about my home group, I thought about the people that I've met, the relationships that I've gathered, the adventures that I've been in that I can actually remember this time. All the time out of handcuffs instead of telling stories about all the times in handcuffs. You know, I got a personal streak running 2.5 years without a hospital visit that wasn't scheduled. You know, and I didn't want to throw all that away. So as even when I find myself in these opportunities, throw it all away, and almost built-in excuses of how bad it is, or how hard it is, or how rough it is, or. And nobody will know how far away I am. I don't know anybody here. I walked right off of Bourbon Street that night and went straight to a meeting. There's meetings in Louisiana, believe it or not. There's meetings all over the place, believe it or not. I've learned that. And I met an old timer in Louisiana. And I mean, it's hard to stay sober down there. Those guys count their years in dog years. And he had like 38 years sober. And he was talking to me about it. And we were swapping war stories. And he finally won. He beat me. He had won. He said he used to call his car the Crawdad because it spent more time in the ditch than on the road. And I was like, okay, you win. You win, sir. You're pretty good, dude. And then I got a little group there. I still talk to those people. So they invited me to an H&I panel. And I went to a hospital and institution panel on the southwest side of the lower ninth ward in New Orleans, Louisiana. And I didn't know it got that bad. So my eyes were opened again as to how much farther I could have gone down the trail, how much farther down I could have dug, how much worse it could have gotten. And something clicked along the lines. Because like I said before, I used to go into these meetings to find excuses to go out. Now I go into meetings and I find excuses to stay in. Find reasons to stay in. Let's not say excuses. That's kind of a cop out. But I eventually, after about a year and a half, 2 years, I got my wife back. It was like a country song in reverse. I got my wife back, I got my dog back, I got my truck back, I got my life back, and I never even tried. I never even did anything. I just gave up and worked on me. You know, instead of trying to hold the reins and steer the world, I just let stuff happen, and I just made one decision after another, one foot in front of the other, and kept going on the same path one day at a time. And then now I'm standing here in front of you guys trying to fill time. But it's amazing how little effort I had to put in to making things better and how much better they got on their own accord. And I didn't do anything except keep coming back and doing what I was told and stop coming up with bright ideas and start following direction. And now, I mean, I used to go fishing and catch a buzz and a DUI. Now I go fishing and catch fish. I felt like I gave myself a raise when I quit drinking. I didn't realize I was throwing $300 at beer and weed every week, $400 in bar tabs. My kids look at me with respect instead of fear, because I don't yell at them with a hangover to be quiet and not be kids, you know. Even my dog listens to me better now. He doesn't have to worry about getting slapped for chewing up a shoe or something. Right? I was an asshole. You hear that? I don't know. Like, and then I actually had this conversation with my son not too long ago. The one that it, my oldest son that I had the confrontation with that started to push the ball down the hill. And when I was 23 and I moved to Santa Maria, he was 16 days old, and his biological father, he's my stepson, his biological father skipped out of town with the rent money, and I was the guy on the couch. I was the drunk guy on the couch, and I saw a young woman and a baby that needed help. I was like, well, I guess I need to pay for rent for this couch now. I went, worked temp labor 3 days, got a job. Her and I got together, and I figured that he kept me out of the bars, and he made me step into manhood from that golden hour of 21 to 23 where bars are novelty and drinking's fun still. I stepped out of that to become his father, and at some point, the arrests slowed down a lot, and the hospital visits got fewer and fewer, and he saved my life. I told him that when he got old enough. He saved my life when you came into my life. Then I told him the other day, you know, that night that you popped me in the jaw and split my head open, I was like, I couldn't really be mad at him for it, because all I ever taught him to do was stand up for what's right, stand up for those who are weak, do the right thing, and be the brave man. I just didn't expect him to do it to me. And he saved my life again. And he got me. If it wouldn't have been for the worst night of my life, all of the best things in my life would have been gone. And the best part of my life never would have happened. So I was just, I think it was, Tuesday you asked me to do this. Thanks for the notice. And I've been thinking a lot about what the hell I was going to talk about. And I just got thrown out the window when I stood up here. But while I was thinking about it, it was really more of going over all this shit that's happened in the last two and a half years. And it all kept boiling back to the worst thing that ever happened to the best part of my life, and how I'll never know what's around the corner just because of what's in front of me. I'll never know what my higher power is, you know, like. You could be flying down a highway at 80 miles an hour, and all of a sudden there's a hairpin turn in front of you. Your back end slides out, you spin out in the gravel, and you almost hit an oncoming car, and then all this crazy shit happens. But then you come out of that corner and straighten it out, and it's the most beautiful view you've ever seen. It's the most wonderful landscape in front of you. And you might not have made that. You know, so what scared me more than anything, what shook me out of my soul, turned into me becoming a better man, me growing into a better place, me becoming an actual father, not just a provider. You know, I always thought I was being a good man and I was taking care of things because I brought home the bacon and then I hid in the garage and drank all the beer. Mm-hmm. And
where was it going?
Well, I guess we're pretty caught up. I could fill it in with some more stories if y'all want to hear. Like Robert used to hide his beer and his liquor in paint buckets. I used to hide mine in my work boots because they smelled so bad I knew she wasn't going to check there. And she'd see the 12-pack in the refrigerator and then she'd wonder how that equated me to being this drunk. It's magic. I don't know. And like, why do you smell like whiskey if all you have is Coors Light? Like, I don't know. Jesus made water into wine. I don't know. It's magic. But now, those are the lies. And I used to lie so much to my wife and kids that I believed it. And it became a persona that I lived. And it wasn't until... when people say peeling back the layers of an onion, for me, it was more like smashing it on the table and looking at the guts. And it all happened so fast and so violently. But I can't remember a better time than right now. I can't remember a better time than right now. Probably because I don't remember a lot of the times before right now. I remember mornings after, and I remember pregame, but I don't remember the fourth quarter of most any of it. And I just never sat back and accepted things for the way they were. It was always either apologizing for what I'd done or planning out the next thing I'm going to do. And never was it my fault. I've never been able to accept responsibility for my own actions. Even when I was on video, I couldn't be held responsible for things I do and say when I don't remember doing or saying them. That's not my fault. That wasn't even me. That was whiskey. Blame Mexico. They made the tequila. not on me. What happened to my paycheck? It just floated away like a butterfly into that pretty bartender's pocket. How did that happen? It wasn't my fault. It was her fault. She shouldn't have dressed like that. You know. But now, in the golden hour, I can accept responsibility for my actions. Because I can accept responsibility for my actions, I don't commit that many actions anymore. You know, if you want to be held in esteem, you do esteemable acts. Isn't that what I've heard people say and things that we're taught? I do better things. I'm a better person. I get respect from my coworkers. And they do what I ask them. I don't have to yell. I don't have to throw fits. I don't have to make scenes. Just politely ask someone to do something. It's a miracle how much they'll do. You know? My kids... I don't yell at them, I don't scream at them, I don't put holes in the wall. And imagine that, freaking room is clean. All I had to do is say, hey, clean your room. Okay, Dad. I told you I didn't have an hour. I got way more time on the bad side of the coin than I do on the good side of the coin. So I could sit here and tell war stories for an hour, but I don't think everybody wants to hear that. We all have war stories, you know. But a lot of people have their cookie-cutter way of running a program. But as long as it works for you and you keep coming back, I would say you work your program and do you, boy or girl. Do you, boo. Robert reads daily reflections. I look at arrest records and pictures of injuries to remember how bad it was. I cycle through my phone every now and then, and find, because I used to take pictures of the injuries so I could share them on Instagram, because that was a mark of achievement to me. Like, look at how drunk I got. I smashed my face. Look at how drunk I got. I got two black eyes and a broken nose. Look at how drunk I got. Here's my arrest record. 6 different charges on one night. That's a new record on my brain. Yeah, so I go back and look at those things. I sit down and read my court papers. I read the transcript of my wife when she's had to stand in front of the DA and talk about her trying to break up a fight between me and a 14-year-old, which I freaking lost.
I'm not ashamed of that. I've seen that dude.
Yeah, he's a big boy. And it's kind of funny how your higher power, the good Lord, Allah, whatever you want to call him, he puts trials, tribulations, and challenges in front of you to test your mettle, to see how you're going to make it, and how you're going to react. And when you think you can't make it and you think you can't react, if you just tune in Tokyo and turn on your radio, he'll send someone to help you. That guy that came and talked to me while I was ugly crying in jail that night in Santa Barbara County, this portly gentleman over here, in his best smirk outfit. He'll tell himself that. It's okay. And the friends that I've made in this program that have taught me things, I mean, they taught me how to be a man, not just a child with a job. You know, John was there at my first meeting. Glenn was there at my first meeting. Robert was there at my very first meeting. Charles, I think I was there at your first meeting. I win. But if you stick around and you don't be shy, we're all ashamed. You know, some of us just face it with experience. Some of us just own it a little bit more gracefully than others. But everybody has a story to tell. Everybody has the war stories. Everybody has advice. If you just tune in that radio to the right frequency and you're willing to accept it and listen to it, you know, your higher power, the Lord, the universe, however you want to call it, he'll always send it. She'll always send it. He'll always be there. You just got to accept it. And there's a lot of pages in the book. What is it, 417? Yeah? 417? Is that the one? Acceptance is the key. Yeah, if you don't read any other page in that book, that's the one I recommend. I don't really know what that will. But, you know, I'm just going to quit rambling now. You can have your spot back. Thanks for listening to me.
Thank you, Travis.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
Give me another round of applause for both of our speakers.